This is an audio archive edition of WINA's Charlottesville Right Now with Coy Barefoot, made available online by the Charlottesville Podcasting Network, cvillepodcast.com.
It was nearly 50 years ago, almost to the day, Friday night, October 30th, 1959, when a DC-3 with 27 souls aboard went missing over the skies of Central Virginia. It was national news at the time, national headlines. They would later discover that the plane had gone off course and had crashed into the side of Buck's Elbow Mountain just west of Crozet. Everyone on board perished except one. One man lived to tell the story, and that's the story that we are going to hear right now. Phil Bradley joins me on the long line from his home in North Carolina. Mr. Bradley, it's an honor to talk to you, sir.
Thank you very much, Coy. It's a joy to be here.
Absolutely. Let's start with the question, what put you on that plane that night? Take us back to 1959, and you were traveling, obviously. What were you doing?
Yeah, I had left Oklahoma City quite early that Friday morning on October 30th. Had reservation from Oklahoma City to Chicago, then Chicago to Washington, then Washington to Roanoke on Piedmont. But when we got to Chicago, the weather was bad, and as a result of the bad weather, we were late leaving Chicago, which caused me to be late getting into Washington, D.C., and which again caused me to be put on standby for Flight 349 because I had missed the flight I was had reservations on. And so I was just on standby at the gate hoping to get aboard the flight when they called it.
And you say the weather was bad. What describe that to us. Was it rainy or snowy, or what was going on? It was October, late October.
In Chicago?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, oh, well, it was just raining, dark and cloudy, and I think maybe some thunderstorms. I don't really know exactly, but all I know is the weather was bad and caused us to leave maybe 35, 40 minutes later.
And you were traveling solo, right? This was a business trip.
Yes, that's correct. I've been in Oklahoma City all week doing some work at the Tinker Air Force Base.
So you are on standby for Flight 349, trying to get home to Danville, right?
No, sir, Roanoke.
Roanoke, that's right. I apologize.
Yes.
This Flight 349 would stop in Charlottesville and then in Roanoke. Was that the plan?
It would stop at Charlottesville, then Lynchburg, then Roanoke. That's just normal, stops from Washington to Roanoke.
Had you flied that leg before?
Yes, quite a few times, yes.
So you're on standby waiting at National Airport to see if you can get on this plane and get home to your family.
Yes, there were quite a few people, seemingly to me, to have apparently reservations on have had reservations on earlier flights that they had missed, and they too were on standby. And so the gate attendant looked at different people and their tickets, and he looked at mine, and he said, okay, Mr. Bradley, get aboard. So I was the last one to get on the flight. When I went on the plane, they just closed the door and locked it up and started the engines. We tacked it on out for takeoff.
So you were passenger 24, the last one to get on board.
That's
and
right.
This was a DC-3, Piedmont Airlines, a DC-3, taking off out of National Airport. Tell us what it was like getting on the plane. You took a seat at the back, right?
Yeah, the only seat available was a single seat in the right rear. And when I got aboard, I didn't know his name at the time, was George Hicks, the flight attendant. Called them pursers in those days. And I just asked him how he's doing, and he said, have a seat. And that was the only seat available. To this day, I wonder, had someone else had that seat, I would have had to take in the seat somewhere else in the plane. Then would that person have lived? I died, or would I still live? He died, or would we all die? I think about that every day.
Amazing. So you get on this flight. About what time is it, you think?
It's approximately 7:30.
7:30, you're flying home to Roanoke with stops in Charlottesville and Lynchburg. You take the last remaining seat, which is at the back of the plane, 24 passengers and three crew.
That's correct.
And I imagine for most of the flight, it was just a normal flight, right?
Yeah, when we took off from Washington National, we climbed up to probably 2,500, 3,500 feet or whatever over Springfield, then picked up Victor 140, which is kind of like Interstate 65 or whatever. And then we had seat belts on. You know, they were already on, but I think about that time we could take them loose if we'd like to and start smoking if we wanted to.
Right. And this plane, the DC-3, has two seats on one side and then just a single row down the other.
I can't really remember the exact configuration of those seats. I thought there were two on my side, but maybe there weren't. Maybe there were two on the other side. I just can't really remember, to be honest with you.
Yeah, but it was a small plane, what today we might call a puddle jumper, just to, you know.
Yeah, I saw those things over at Normandy during the invasion, carrying, you know, paratroopers and pulling gliders and all that stuff. It was a workhorse in World War II as a C-47.
Right. We're talking with Philip Bradley, the only survivor of the historic DC-3 plane crash in Albemarle County on the night of Friday, October 30th, 1959. And Mr. Bradley is coming back to Central Virginia, and he will stand there at the monument at Mint Springs Park. And we want to get all the information about that so folks can come out there and share that moment with you as you go back 50 years to the day of the plane crash, which will, of course, take place at the end of this month. And you, we'll talk about that before we let you go. So you're flying along. Tell us about the scene on the on the plane as you're traveling. You're expected to get in about when, you think?
Into Charlottesville?
Into Charlottesville or Roanoke, yes, sir.
I don't really know exactly what time. Probably maybe 10 o'clock, 10:30 in Roanoke, I guess.
Okay.
I don't really remember.
And the plane is full. Every seat is taken.
Sure, yes.
Mm-hmm. Were there a lot of people talking, or what was it like? Was it quiet?
There were people talking. In fact, when we were taxiing out to the runway for takeoff, I could see a pretty view of the Washington Monument. There's a lady sitting right across the aisle from me, and I just touched her on her right arm and asked her if she'd like to see a pretty view of the Washington Monument. And she just kind of stooped down or lowered her head and could see. She said, "It sure is." That's the last conversation I had with anybody on the plane. We took off runway 33, I believe, which is a 330-degree heading. And, yeah, the flight was fairly normal, and people talking and going to the restroom, things like drinking coffee. And but then when we were getting closer to Charlottesville, the seatbelt comes back on and no smoking and all this kind of stuff. And something I've never understood really is why the purser was pouring coffee in paper cups when I thought we would normally be landing in Charlottesville. But and then I thought that, well, maybe the weather was too bad. We were going home to Lynchburg rather than land at Charlottesville. But just we made some various and sundry turns around Charlottesville. I know we were over Charlottesville. The Civil Air and Ice Board says we were not, but I know we were because of a searchlight that Kroger was utilizing as advertising for a store that they had opened in Barracks Road Shopping Center.
That was the, absolutely. They had a big Hollywood-type searchlight out there going back and forth. That was the...
Yeah, that was a 60-inch searchlight. And I know the first trip we took from Southampton, England, over Omaha Beach, we had a bunch of those on the ship and 90-millimeter guns, the men that manned them, and all the ammo. That's a carbon-operated 60-inch searchlight. That light came right up through the clouds and fog and hit right under the right wing on my side of the plane.
So you were...
The Civil Aeronautics Board said we did not come over Charlottesville.
Interesting. That, of course, was the... that searchlight was out there because the Barracks Road Shopping Center was celebrating its grand opening celebration that very weekend.
That's correct.
And
yes,
that searchlight was out there for some time, I believe.
Yeah, I think... Well, Kroger had it for a couple of weeks out there, I think. I understand it.
Yeah, so you actually saw that light then bounce off the plane.
I saw the... The beam of the light came up through the clouds and all. It was right under the right wing. In fact, we made some turns, and later on it came the second time. So I don't know what kind of turns we were making, but it came under the second time, and it wasn't too long after that second one that we hit the mountain.
So tell us now. We're talking with Philip Bradley, honored to have him on the program. tell us, the plane had started a descent, is that right? You thought you were going in for the landing.
Well, after making those different turns and all, I didn't know where we were, what we were doing, of course, but it wasn't too long, and it was right at 20 minutes to 9, we hit at 8:40, and the plane kind of got in straight and level flight, I assumed, and then I felt the wheels come down when they started extending the wheels, getting ready to land.
Right.
And on those planes, it felt like they were going to stop and drop when they do that. But that's what happened. And somebody on the middle of the plane on the left-hand side, I assume, had just told a punchline to a joke. And they were all laughing. The light that I had over my seat was not burning. And I couldn't read. I had purchased a book, Exodus, in Chicago, and read 13 pages coming down to Chicago, to Washington. So I couldn't read anymore because of that light. And I'm just sitting there with my arms crossed, and all of a sudden I heard the wings hitting what I thought were trees or whatever. And that fella told a punchline to a joke, and they were all laughing. And about that time, the most horrible noise and crash you ever saw. And when that happened, nobody screamed, nobody hollered, it never did. Even before, I mean, during the accident and afterwards. No sounds of pain or noise or screaming or any of that. And but I had that beautiful vision of Jesus Christ right about the impact, standing what I estimated to be 3 to 4 feet off the ground with his hands pointing up like to heaven, had on a long white robe which illuminated the side of the mountain, no shoes on, long beard and hair. He looked right at me with his eyes blinking and his lips, I could see his lips moving, his eyes blinking. And he said to me, "Be concerned not, I will be with you always." And, you know, just a split second after that, I was getting dirt and leaves in my mouth. It's when we hit the ground. That's when I hit the ground.
We're honored to be talking with Philip Bradley. He is the sole survivor of a historic plane crash in Albemarle County in October of 1959. We'll continue this conversation on the other side of this break for local news and weather. Stay with us. On my front porch swing, smell of shrimp there began to boil. Let's rejoin our conversation with Philip Bradley. He is the sole survivor of the historic plane crash. A DC-3 crashed in Albemarle County in 1959, and he will be here at the end of the month to stand there at the monument in Mint Springs Park near Crozet at a public event, free and open to the public, if you want to join him. And we'll get the details here near the top of the hour before we let him go. We'll get the full details on this event coming up. Mr. Bradley, when we broke off there just a few minutes ago, you were telling us about the actual crash. As the plane was coming down, they lowered the wheels, you heard the wings hitting the tops of trees, it sounds like.
Yes, that's correct. They were hitting, I can't say for sure they were hitting trees, but I just assumed they were because I just felt we were in that general area of Charlottesville, which would be trees. We could have been hitting buildings for all I really know, but I just felt they were trees. And like I mentioned earlier, somebody had told a punchline to a joke on the left-hand side, the plane in the middle, and they were all laughing as that plane hit. But yeah, the wheels were extended. They came down, getting ready to land, I assume.
And the moment of impact is when you had your vision of Jesus Christ, and he spoke directly to you.
That's correct. When that plane hit that mountain and all that terrific noise and everything, right ahead of me was the vision of Christ. I estimate he was standing 3 to 4 feet off the ground, and with his had on a long white robe. It came to his ankles, and it was illuminated. It illuminated the side of that mountain. That's what confirmed to me in my mind there were trees, because trees were coming up out of the dirt. There were no grass or weeds or anything around the trees. It was just the trunks of trees coming out of dirt. And he didn't have any shoes on. And he had a long beard and a long hair, held his hands up like pointing them to heaven. He looked right at me. I could see his eyes blinking and his lips moving. And he looked right at me and said, "Be concerned not. I'll be with you always." The next thing I know, I'm getting dirt and leaves in my mouth. And, you know, that's when I stopped going wherever I went, you know.
Yeah. So we would learn later that you were actually thrown from the plane, still strapped to your seat. Is that right?
That's correct, as I normally kid when I talk to groups of people that I paid for my seat and took it with me.
But you don't remember, well, tell us now, what do you remember then as you, in those first few moments after the crash?
Well, the only thing I really remember vividly is the vision of Christ and the terrific noise that was involved. The next thing I know, as I said, I was getting dirt and leaves in my mouth, and just as the crash occurred, I looked at my watch, it was 20 minutes to 9, 8:40, and, after I stopped rolling and all and getting dirt and leaves in my mouth, I just started feeling myself for internal injuries and laceration. It took 4 or 5 minutes to really figure out what happened because I didn't really know what happened. And I checked myself for internal injuries and hollered to see if anybody responded to me. Nobody say anything. And there was a few fires that, you know, came up like electrical wires or batteries or something. It flared up maybe 3 or 4 times and then went out and never did come back. And then I thought to myself, well, I'll be dog, I'm going to be able to get up and walk away from here. I took a seatbelt to loose and started to get up, and that's when the first pain hit. My left foot was going the opposite direction of my right foot. My right knee and right foot were messed up, too, so I knew I wasn't going to go anywhere.
And this was Friday evening, October 30th, 1959, as you lay strapped to your seat there on Buck's Elbow Mountain. And aside from those few fires that gradually went out there from the plane crash, you were in complete darkness there.
That's correct, yes. And it was, temperature, I understand, was around 38 degrees that night and foggy. And I was awfully dry, you know, needing water. And I was bad about not drinking enough water back in those days. And anyway, I'd let my head come back and you know, maybe catch some water in my mouth, but hit me everywhere but in my mouth. But I just had, it was just a terrific amount of pain, terrible pain. I'd get in a position where I could tolerate the right side, and then when I'd get in a position to do that, then the left side would hurt. So I'd get in a position to satisfy the left side, then the right side. I just couldn't win. And that went on pretty much all night long.
And as, pain. Yeah, as you lay up there on the mountain, is that when you have memories of hearing what we now know was the football game over at Albemarle High School?
Yes, I could hear, I didn't know what it was, of course, but I could hear, and you know how a crowd will cheer and roar and all that when a touchdown is scored or a pass or something. That's what it appeared to me when somebody, the bands would band, you know, make noise and people would holler. And and it just reminded me of a football game or somebody at some kind of a sporting event. And I found out later that's what it was a football game over there, as I understand it.
Now tell us, as the morning broke on that Saturday morning, Halloween day, and the sun began to come down through the trees, what did you see?
Well, there was no sun coming down through the trees that morning. It didn't come in until probably around 11 o'clock. But early that morning, probably 6:30 or 7 o'clock, I heard some noise a little bit below me, and I looked down to see what it could be. And it was two bears, a big one and a little one, coming, you know, walking that way. And I thought, what the heck? So the big bear stopped and then stood up and looked all around, and I'd estimate probably 6 to 7 feet in height, and the little one probably her cub, as I think now. And she stood up on her hind legs for a few minutes, then just came back down on all fours and wandered on off into the woods. Never did see or hear of them anymore. But that night, though, before it got daylight, I could hear wildcats hollering and all, and dogs barking, you know, that type thing.
Right, right. Tell us about that morning then, as the as you begin to really wake up and get your first good look around at the crash.
Well, when it started getting daylight, you know, I had realized earlier, I mean, maybe 5 or 10, 15 minutes after we hit, what really happened. And since I had not heard anybody, I assumed that maybe that a lot of people or some of them could still be unconscious or whatever. But when it got daylight, for the most part, what I could see, there would, you know, there wouldn't, I could see why there was no hollering or screaming or, you know, that type thing. And so it reminded me a little bit of Normandy, Omaha Beach, and I just kind of feel, have always felt, that what I saw on Omaha Beach that June 6th morning probably made it possible for me to go through that without, hopefully, too much emotional strain on me and my mind and so forth.
So you had been mentally prepared for the tragic scene that you saw?
I think so, because I had just turned 18 at Normandy, and I was 33 years old in this accident. So I've always felt that, and so, and I'll hold to it because I try not to think about that at all. Just, you know, it's something, you know, you don't want to go through, but it's something that you go through. And I've had many people ask me if I felt guilty being the only one that lived and so forth, and I would always answer the question, I have always answered it by saying that, no, I have never felt guilty. The good Lord made that decision. I didn't have anything to do with it.
Tell us about that Saturday, because it would be another a full day and a full night before anybody actually got up there and found you.
Yeah, that's right. You had mentioned earlier about the sun that morning. Well, the sun didn't clear up. I mean the sun. The fog didn't clear up until about 11 o'clock, I'd say. Then I could start seeing planes flying over, you know, search planes. But, you know, the color in the mountains that time of the year, we were pretty much camouflaged down under there. And, it got clear right nice there around 11 o'clock, stayed nice till about 2 or 2.30, and then pretty soon the fog started coming in again, and I thought to myself, well, they can't see me down here in the fog, and I figured I'm going to have to be up there another day at least.
So that was all day Saturday, and what was Saturday night like? It was cold again, too, that night.
Yeah, but I don't recall it being quite as cold as it was on Friday night, but I had fished a coat, had a stick, got a coat and pulled it over on me, and I used my seat cushion of my seat as a pillow and on the first night, and then put my face into the back of the seat to keep my face warm. But then the next day, when I got daylight where I could find that coat and all I pulled over on me, then I was, as far as the elements were concerned, I was in fairly good shape that night, the second night.
Right, right. So Sunday morning, when did you first get any indication that the search party had at last found where you were?
Well, I don't know, Coy, why I felt this way or thought the way that I did. I felt that if any rescue people came, they would come up the mountain. And so I was just always expecting somebody to come up the mountain. And all of a sudden, I started hearing noises above me. Somebody would holler to somebody else, do you see anything yet? The other, whoever he was hollering to, would holler back, no, do you? He'd say no. Then I could start hearing them. They were coming down the mountain, which kind of, you know, I'm glad they were coming, but I didn't know why they were coming from down the mountain. But anyway, the second time they hollered at each other, they weren't too far away, I didn't think. Then I started hollering to them, over here is the plane crash. Over here is the plane crash, kept hollering. And it wasn't just but a short while, the first person that showed up was this Air Force paramedic, Sergeant Weiss. And then just a very short time after that, a Corporal Harris showed up. They were the first two people that I'm aware of that came in there that morning. And I shook hands with them, was kidding with them, and said, where you guys been? He said, we've been looking. I said, well, I told him, I said, I'm okay. Go check, see if anybody else is alive. And they said, looked at me, Sergeant Weiss did, and he looked at me and said, well, thanks. So he went and wasn't gone very long and came back. And I said, is anybody alive? He said, don't know yet. I said, you know there's nobody alive. And it wasn't too long after that, Coy, that I never have understood this, that just a lot of people started coming in from everywhere, it seemed like. I couldn't understand how they got in there so fast, but they did. But then the doctors came in, state troopers, and people like that, and I have to admire the work that the Crozet Fire Department and all of these different rescue squads in Waynesboro and Crozet and Charlottesville and all around did in finding that, helped finding that and helped getting the people out of there. And I remember talking to the doctor. He wanted to know what was wrong with me. I told him, I said, well, my left hip, I think, broken, and my right knee and foot probably broken. I don't really know. And he checked me over, and he said, well, you're pretty close. And I asked him how they planned to get me out of here. He said, we're going to let the helicopter come and drop the cable down and put me in that basket, you know, the basket they put you in, and winch me up to the helicopter. And I said, oh, no. Do that. The wind was blowing real hard up there that morning. And he said, well, the only other way we'd be able to get you out would be to carry up on top of the mountain. I said, that's okay, except you're going to have to give me some morphine or something before you move me. He said, oh, yeah, we'll do that. So he gave me a shot and waited maybe 20 minutes or so. He gave me another shot. And as I tell people, I think 20 minutes after that, I could have walked out by myself. But anyway, those people, I think some of them were the Crozet Fire Department helped carry me out of there, and other people around and different rescue squads and all. Fantastic job. I was talking with a fellow the other day about how smooth it was carrying me up to the mountain where the helicopter was. And he, you know, right on up there. But when one fellow would get tired, he'd drop out, another fellow would fill in, and then just smooth right on up to the top. And that's rugged. That's a rugged mountain right there.
Yeah, that's I have heard that's a one tough hike, even to go up to that site of the plane crash. We're talking with Philip Bradley. He was the sole survivor of the historic plane crash in Albemarle County in October of 1959. So they get you to the hospital, and then they go to work on you. Is that right?
Yes. Fact of the matter is, this coming 31st at 10, you know, when I'm going to have the remembrance ceremony up there at Immense Springs Valley Park, Dr. Frank McHugh is going to speak at that remembrance program. He was there when they took me in the emergency entrance to the University of Virginia Hospital. But before they took me in, my oldest brother was a captain on the Virginia State Police Force. And he heard about the plane being found when he was coming through Lovingston, coming towards Charlottesville. And he heard on his radio that the airplane crash had been found and that there was only one survivor. And he'd get on his radio and find out who it was. He didn't know. And they didn't know either at the time. And he asked him to let him know. So he said about a half hour, they called him back and said, a boy from Clifton Forge, Virginia, named Phil Bradley. He said, that's my brother. But they took me out of the ambulance at UVA. But I do want to say this. I like to kid about this. But when they flew me off the mountain, I guess a little air pocket or something, one of the sheriffs sat right down on that hip when he got unbalanced and sat right down on my
hip. Oh, no.
But if I hadn't had the morphine, I don't know what I'd done. But anyway, we landed at Scott Stadium. They put me in an ambulance to go to the hospital, and I think Richard Petty was driving. He was flying. I said, slow down. I've been on the mountains 2 days. I don't know of any hurry to get over to the hospital. So anyway, they got me on over there, went inside. Dr. Franklin, Dr. McHugh, checking me out, and they gave me a spinal, you know. Dr. Schubert, I remember, was the anesthesiologist, gave me the spinal. And Dr. McHugh and Dr. Frankel, they got a halt somehow to pull the hip leg down or whatever and turn it and push it back in the socket, but they couldn't get enough strength behind it, me laying up on the table. So they said, well, put him on the floor. So they laid me down on the floor where they could get on their knees and get their backs into it, and I could feel it go in. Went right on in there, sick as a cat. I told him, I said, you got it that time.
26 people died that Friday night, October 30th, 1959. Phil Bradley was the only survivor of that historic plane crash. And, Mr. Bradley, that was the national news at the time. It was the first time in American history we'd had such a crash with just one survivor.
That's what I understand. I was the first sole survivor of a commercial airline crash this country, as I understand it. Yes, it made worldwide news. I got little pens and cards and stuff from people from Nigeria, Germany, everywhere when I was in the hospital.
And you're returning to Albemarle County from your home in North Carolina in just a couple of weeks. Tell us about the remembrance ceremony and give us the details.
Well, in October of 1999, I'd been having a desire really to remember the people. I felt they should be remembered. And the fact of the matter is, I've kind of, you know, as I get older, feel more of a spiritual relationship with those people. But anyway, I wanted to build it, and I went before the Albemarle County Board of Supervisors with a rendering to show them what I had in mind, and they approved it and approved perpetual care for it at Mint Springs Valley Park. And we went up and built it. My wife and son and I, we built it, and we dedicated it on October the 2nd, 1999, a little over 10 years ago. And we're going to have a remembrance dedication on October the 31st, which will be the 50th anniversary plus one day at Mint Springs Valley Park at that memorial.
And what time will that be on that Saturday?
Be 10 a.m.
10 a.m. on Saturday, and that's Halloween Day, October 31st this year.
Yes.
Phil Bradley will be there. Your doctor, the intern that got your hip back in there, Frank McHugh,
yep,
will be speaking as well. And this event is free and open to the public, and yep, anybody is welcome to join you out there for the event.
Yes, Mrs. Malik, one of the supervisors, Albemarle County Board Supervisors, will speak. And Mrs. Parton, minister at the Presbyterian Church in Crozet, she'll speak. And I'm trying to arrange for a flyover with an old DC-3, just like the one that crashed in, to fly over the, you know, the remembrance service.
Oh, that'd be something. Mr. Bradley, I want to thank you for your time, and I especially want to thank you for your unselfish generosity for sharing your story with us. And I agree with you. It's very appropriate to remember those folks who didn't make it off that mountain that night. And hopefully folks will be able to join you 10 a.m. on Saturday morning, October 31st, there at Mint Springs Park. Thank you so much, sir.
Thank you, Coy. I appreciate it.
You've been listening to Charlottesville Right Now with Coy Barefoot. Charlottesville Right Now is broadcast live Monday through Friday on News Radio 1070 WINA from 4 to 6 p.m. Best-selling author and historian Coy Barefoot is the host and producer. To interact with Coy and his guests, you can call 434-977-1070. Coy can be reached at barefoot@wina.com. This audio download has been made possible by the Charlottesville Podcasting Network. Visit SeavillePodcast.com for more.